Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, the 30th of December, 1999. We're in the fireside room this evening. Presenter's name is Jay McDivitt. Today's session number is MCJA99-1. It is the second session of the Peace is the Way retreat and is entitled Gender and Ecological Violence. Let's listen in.
I think we're going to continue singing that song that we learned last night under Joe's leadership. He's not here right now, which unfortunately means that I would have to lead it. But it's and everyone eat their vine and fig tree shall live in peace and unafraid. And into plowshares beat their swords, nations shall learn war no more. And remember the round portion, hopefully we'll get there at some point.
And everyone eat their vine and fig tree, shall live in peace and unafraid. And everyone eat their vine and fig tree, shall live in peace and unafraid. And into plowshares beat their swords, nations shall learn war no more. And into plowshares beat their swords, shall learn war no more. And everyone in their vine and fig tree, and everyone in their vine and fig tree, shall live in peace and plowshares beat their swords. And everyone in their vine and fig tree, shall live in peace and plowshares beat their swords.
McAllister's book, You Can't Kill the Spirit, Stories of Women and Nonviolent Action, and it's a book just filled with stories of women and what women have done in the sphere of active nonviolence. What has drawn me most strongly to nonviolence is its capacity for encompassing a complexity necessarily denied by violent strategies. By complexity, I mean the sword faced by feminists who rage against the system of male supremacy, but at the same time love their fathers, sons, husbands, brothers, and male friends. I mean the complexity which requires us to name an underpaid working man who beats his wife, both as someone who is oppressed and as an oppressor. Violent tactics and strategies rely on polarization and dualistic thinking and require us to divide ourselves into the good and bad, assume neat, rigid little categories easily answered from the barrel of a gun. Nonviolence allows for the complexity inherent in our struggles and requires a reasonable acceptance of diversity and an appreciation for our common ground.
Tonight, once again, we're going to combine two sessions out of the manual, two different topics, but ones that we feel are really important and I think fit in importantly at Holden as well. The question of gender and nonviolence as far as women, because there are some different dynamics there, and then also ecology and the whole violence against the environment. This morning already, the question of what it means that sort of women have been historically taught to submit to violence means then when we're trying to develop a different model of active nonviolence. So what I want to do tonight in starting out is just talk about some of the stories of women who have resisted nonviolently and hear some of them from you maybe as well, names of women, because although we don't hear their names perhaps as often as Gandhi and Martin Luther King and others, women have been leaders in the struggle and in the nonviolent modeling. And I just wanted to point out one of the very first stories in the Bible is a story of women's nonviolent resistance that does embody some of the characteristics that we talked about last night. It's not passivity, but it's rather figuring out sort of savvy ways to resist but without the use of violence. And this is the story from Exodus about the Hebrew midwives, two women named Shiphrah and Puah. So I'll just read it. Then the king of Egypt said that to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shiphrah and the other Puah, "When you serve as midwife to the Hebrew women and see them upon the birth stool, if it is a son, you shall kill him, but if it is a daughter, she shall live." But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but they let the male children live. So the king of Egypt called the midwives and said to them, "Why have you done this and let the male children live?" The midwives said to Pharaoh, now notice they're, it's not exactly lying, but it's resistance.
But it is.
Well, maybe it's true. The midwife said to Pharaoh, "The Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are vigorous and are delivered before the midwife comes to them." So God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and grew very strong. And because the midwives feared God, God gave them families. So this is an example, I think, of the kind of resistance we're talking about that is not sort of direct confrontation, perhaps, but nonetheless has that element of surprise and changes the dynamics here. And there are many more stories in Scripture of women also who resisted. And I thought tonight we could start by naming some women's names. Hopefully we can come up with some here through history who have been models of nonviolent resistance, because I think it is really important to get these stories out as well in the history of nonviolent transformation. We don't often, or some women have typically been overlooked in telling history, and so we need to get those names back as well. So Tara said she'd write them up if we come up with some names.
I can't remember the names. The two women that were leaders, the leaders in the suffragette movement. I was just reading about them. They were so incredible.
Elizabeth Cady Stanton?
Right, right, right.
And Susan B. Anthony?
Right, 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 right. I thought they were great.
Yeah, and there was that Ken Burns special on TV. Oops, I guess we don't get any TV up here, Holden, but it was, I think it was three parts. It was just about a month ago. It was very good. Yeah. About them, about Susan B. Anthony. Others?
Joan Baez.
The woman who was the who's in Burma, I forget her name, won the Nobel Peace Prize.
Oh, Aung San Suu Kyi. Yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's a good one. Suu Kyi is K-Y-I, I think.
The Rebecca riots, which happened a few hundred years ago, it was a group of women in England who rose up against fighting, and it came to be known as the Rebecca riots, and now a folk trio is named after them.
Margaret. Rosa Parks?
Rosa Parks.
Margaret Bell, who is the founding mother of the Society of Friends and wrote constant letters and made constant visits to the king until George Fox was released from prison.
Huh.
Is it F-E-L-L? Mm-hmm.
Dorothy Day?
Day. Do you want to say a word about her? Maybe everybody knows who she is, but...
Started the Catholic Orphan Movement.
Uh-huh, in New York City in this century. Uh-huh.
All the unnamed women who worked in cathedrals in the Middle Ages along with the men sculptors and put into concrete form their visions of God and angels and myth. Many, many women.
Was it Mother Jones, the labor organizer?
I was just reading about Florence Nightingale. I didn't, you know, you sort of hear that she's a kind of a folk hero, but I didn't realize how much she was resisting the tradition of the male-dominated professional medical world at the time. She was pretty revolutionary in what she was doing.
Betty Williams.
Yeah, the Nobel Peace Prize. You want to say a word about her?
Betty Williams and Mary Corrigan McGuire are women involved in the peace process. Betty Williams won in 76, 1996, I won the Nobel Peace Prize.
And we should say, I put there some brochures from the Fellowship of Reconciliation, I don't know if anybody wants to take one, describing this decade for nonviolence that starts the day after tomorrow, that all the living Nobel Peace Prize winners have signed on to. And I think Betty Williams was one of the organizers of that. So, but she and other Nobel Peace Prize winners got all of the Nobel Peace Prize winners to sign, including Yasser Arafat. I mean, everybody is on there. So it's a pretty impressive accomplishment, and she's been very active in organizing.
And including Mother Teresa, who is another one for here, who also never signs anything. Very rarely would put her name to it. An official document. She's fine.
Rigoberto
Menchú.
Domitia Barrios de Chungara from Bolivia.
Who is the last one?
Domitia Barrios de Chungara. Who she's, I mean, out of all Latin American testimonials from women, Rigoberta and Domitia are the most famous. She rose up against oppressive mining conditions, and was one of the actual forefront of the movement to close down these mines that were horrible working conditions, and sickness was bred, and poverty, and
in which country? Wow.
In Bolivia.
Huh. And then the mothers of the disappeared in Latin America, who, for, you know, in Argentina after the disappearances, kept the struggle alive there. Other women?
Nuns.
Yeah, the four in El Salvador and many others.
Hanan Ashrawi.
Hanan Ashrawi, Palestinian. You want to say any more about
her? She's a Palestinian activist and politician now in the Palestinian governing body, and has been a strong voice for the peace process and for making it something that holds Israel accountable.
Juliet Lowe, who started the Girl Scouts, which was the first movement for girls like that.
How do you spell her last name?
L-O-W-E.
L-O-W-E, yeah.
Jeanette
Rankin.
Jeanette Rankin from Montana, who was the only woman, or only senator to not vote for deployment of troops in either World War I or World War II.
Jennifer Harberry. Mm-hmm. Now who's this?
She's an American lawyer whose husband was Guatemalan killed.
Could you say the name one more time?
Jennifer Harberry, H-A-R-B-U-R-Y.
Who is it that did the tenement houses? Hull House. Jane Hull.
Jane Addams started Hull House, that's right.
Yeah.
I have to drive by there to get to Greek restaurants, so I should remember that. Sojourner Truth, we didn't name her.
Inherent
Deanna Ortiz, who's an American nun, kidnapped and tortured in Guatemala, and she's been fighting the government to get her information released from the CIA.
Huh. I'm going to put down Peace Pilgrim.
Who?
Peace Pilgrim.
Yeah. Well, thanks. This is an amazing list, and it's really important to remind ourselves how significant women have been in this movement as well.
Ruth Yandel Nelson.
Yes. Yeah, let's put Ruth Yandel Nelson and Helen Prejean against the death penalty.
Prejean.
Janet, say a little bit about Ruth Yandel.
Yeah, that's a good
one. Mother of the Year, 1973. Went out with her son, John Nelson, who is a retired pastor from Seattle, in protest of a Trident submarine, a little rowboat. And, did everything she did in her later years after she became Mother of the Year was related to peace. She came up here to be the keynote speaker on a weekend for Youth Weekend when the issue was in sexuality, but it was quickly gone past sexuality to peace issues.
Yeah, she's reported to have said, if if we get blown up in the bomb, there won't be any sex anyway, so what I need to talk to you about is peace. So that's a good segue to use at Holden.
You get him here. That's how you get him here.
There's Rufina, I don't know her last name, the one who was the sole survivor of El Mazote and worked for 10 years. 900 people were killed, and they were all literally buried. And it took her 10 years to convince people that the atrocity had happened. She was in that movie today.
Yeah.
Winnie Mandela.
Helen Caldicott. Mm-hmm. There's a Physicians for Social Responsibility.
Yeah. What? How do you spell her last name?
Caldicott, CALDICOTT.
And is she the founder?
Well, she's one of the original leaders of the
group. Oh, Margaret Sanger.
Yeah, Margaret Sanger, remember?
Okay. Next, I wanted to review the four-step process we had talked about this morning. Does anybody remember some of the steps? The first one was
centering
ourselves. The second,
truth for yourself.
Yeah. Okay. So the first one was centering ourselves. The second one was being able to define your own truth. So sort of an I statement. The third was
Receive the truth of others,
and then the fourth was agreement. Because those second and third steps involve speaking and listening, and that's such an important part of any active nonviolence process, we're going to practice that tonight, and we're going to do it where we'll divide up into pairs, and we'll want both genders in that pair. So if you could find someone of the opposite gender near you, and if it just so happens we have more women than men or vice versa, that's okay. And I don't know, does everybody have a pair, somebody near them, the opposite gender they can count on? You might need to arrange yourself. What they heard. Wrap up and then join with another pair near you and introduce yourselves to each other. Okay, here's a small group question. What did you feel while you were doing this listening exercise? What did you feel while you were doing this listening exercise? What experiences have you had where violence has been related to gender? Another question to talk about. So each individual shares on whatever level they feel comfortable. What experiences have you had where violence has been related to gender? Okay, let's come back together. Thank you for all that discussion. Are there one or two insights some of the small groups would like to share with the larger groups from your small group discussion? Yeah.
I was going to say, I think my take on the first exercise of women talking, men repeating back, I have to say that my idea was that maybe there would be some disparity, and that was the point of the exercise, in what men heard versus what women said. And I think Holden's kind of a typical environment to do that exercise. I found within my own age group that I've had a lot of disparity between communication with male counterparts of mine, and that even when you think things are completely locked in and okay, you find out little by little later that we were on completely two different planes that didn't even come close to touching. So I just thought that was an interesting observation that perhaps in a more normal setting, there would be, and if it weren't 2 minutes long too, that's pretty easy to remember, but that there could have been, I think Holden is kind of a funny place to do this.
Are there any other comments about that exercise? Or how about the rest of your small group discussions? Any other insights?
Yeah, one of the things we talked about was that sometimes that we think of violence would be that men are dominating women, but that there was an experience that came out where a woman was dominating men, and that was part of a home structure also. And so that I think that it's always in the discussions, it's important to think of, you know, the violence against a person of any gender can come from any other gender.
We talked, I heard in our group that violence is that happen quickly, and you see it, and it happens so quickly that you can't respond even if you wanted to, and how violating, especially if you're an observer, that can be.
Do you want to give an example?
Examples of you at the Cairo airport.
Being in a crowd and someone inappropriately touching someone. Or giving glances or looks.
My comment was related to the one two back, but about women being violent as well. I do dating violence prevention workshops in grade 11 high school classes. Wow. And one of the first overheads that I put up is reports a study where high school students and college students have answered the question, and 40% of girls will admit to having been violent in their dating relationships, but only 33% of guys will. So, I just always bring that one up to, you know, what's the reason? Is it our definition of violence? Or,
yeah.
To add to that, I said this in a conversation a few weeks ago here at Holden. I worked at a domestic violence intervention project, and they had done research on same-sex partners, and it was alarming to me how high violence was, regardless of gender. That it is something that power structures are established in such a way that it goes beyond gender in our society in many cases.
It's interesting, actually, that statement kind of runs contrary to the next exercise that I was going to do, but I'm glad that you brought that up, because that does show that there are various different ways of looking at it. I think one of the benefits of that particular exercise is that I think it shows that men have a lot to learn from women, and I think that which is not to say that we don't all have something to learn from everyone, but in particular, a way in which this was made kind of brutally clear to myself was that we had on our campus, we had a speaker come, and what the speaker did was led an exercise, and so I'd like to kind of go through that very briefly, and we can have discussion on it if you'd like, but I think the point of it, at least with us, was so blatantly obvious that there wasn't much time really or reason for discussion. And that is that if we all close our eyes and try to imagine a world, and imagine a world in which all of the violence exacted upon people by women, all of the violent acts of women did not exist, what would be different about the world? How would the world be different? And now, if you would close your eyes also and imagine a world in which all of the violence perpetrated by men did not exist, what would be different? I think the point of that, in and we can open this up for discussion for sure, is that if we want to talk about violence being perpetrated upon others, the vast majority, especially physical violence, but the vast majority of violence that is present in our world, be it war, ecological violence, violence in relationships, etc., does happen at the hands of men, and that there is a power structure that's at work there, and that what we're talking about tonight is what we can learn from the feminist movement and principles of the feminist movement that can deepen our understanding of nonviolence. Now, this might sound kind of like a disclaimer, and I think it probably should, I guess. And that is that I'm not a woman, which I think should be blatantly obvious. If it's not, that's fine. But that's never offended me. But and so for a man to lead a discussion or to even attempt to enter into a discussion on feminism can be problematic, and I recognize that, and I want you to know that I do recognize that. But that for me, this is an issue which has given me a lot of hope and has deepened my understanding not only of nonviolence, but also of my own spirituality and my own theology, and has been a great deal of my own both personal and actual formal education. And so because of that, I invite as much criticism and critique as possible so that this can be a fair and an enlightening discussion. But that I'm going to be kind of facilitating discussion, but that doesn't at all mean that this is being led or directed by me. So that's just kind of a disclaimer to talk about why it is that I happen to be leading this particular section, even though it's that it is these women here who should be leading that. So anyway, to kind of plunge into it, what is the gift of feminism to nonviolent structure, to this paradigm of nonviolent movement and action? Obviously, we saw at the beginning with our discussion of women throughout the history of nonviolence and women throughout history that women have really gotten a hold of and gotten a grasp of nonviolence in some very, very powerful ways, in many ways much more powerful than a lot of men. There have been some amazing, powerful social movements led by men, but there have also been amazing, powerful social movements, nonviolent social movements led by women as well. But I think in order to understand that, we need to understand what it is that feminism gives to both the nonviolent movement and also the ecological movement, which we'll talk about a little bit later as well. Both of those movements, the ecological movement and the feminist movement, have definite connections to nonviolence. Of course, there are violent feminist movements, there are violent ecological movements, there are violent anti-racism movements as well. But nonviolence has been provided an amazing depth and breadth by both the feminist and the environmental or ecological movement. And that's what we need to talk about tonight. Now, why is it that we need to address feminism in order to understand nonviolence? And that's kind of the question is why, what is a feminist nonviolence? What is the connection between those two? And these are some kind of statements that I'll read that come out of the book. These are from various different thinkers, such as Elizabeth Susher Fiorenza, who teaches at Harvard, M. Sean Copeland, I'm not sure where she is, and others. One is, we cannot speak of violence and nonviolence without addressing the widespread emotional, verbal, physical, cultural, and economic violence against women in the home, the workplace, the streets, and in the wider world. What's your reaction to that statement? We cannot talk about violence and nonviolence without addressing widespread emotional, verbal, physical, cultural, and economic violence against women in the home, the workplace, in the streets, and in the wider world.
I'm going to be devil advocate on that. Because I don't know why you couldn't slip in the word instead of women, children, or slip in the word men. I'm sensing like an exaltation of feminism in this thing here, and I'm not sure why we're doing it. Like, is it inherently better? In your thing, like, I'm thinking Margaret Thatcher led for a long time England, and they were involved in a variety of military conflicts during that time. So, you know, how does it exalt to being correct? And why couldn't we insert the word men or children in that expression? I'm not sure why we couldn't.
Okay, I think that's an interesting question. I certainly have my own views, but Annalisa, you seem to have a response to that.
Take back the night marches that I've participated in. I've had male friends of mine ask, you know, why can't I be included in this? Or, you know, why isn't this experience extended to men? Because that seems very exclusive and seems creating barriers, whatever. But I think there's just kind of a, without maybe being able to articulate it really well, Take Back the Night is women going out in the street at night and for once saying we're unified and we're feeling safe because we're together walking on the streets. Because every other time, every other instance, every other moment that we're not in a group like this marching, we don't feel safe. And there's a general feeling that in a lot of situations, men don't have the same fears as women because the same things don't happen to the two groups. So I think inherently it's important to address violence specifically against women because it's a pandemic and institutionalized and systemic part of our culture that men and women have very different experiences going through all levels of our society, that and men won't be able to understand that if they're not a woman to some levels. But I think a lot of women here could say that's why we're addressing it, because there's a fear that's always there. There's the realization that I might work just as hard but not get equal pay. I walk down the street and I get catcalled. I mean, there's just very different meeting roads here. That's why it's important to address. I mean, and they're very different realms. Some men won't be able to understand that. And women, just on the other hand, don't know necessarily what it's like to have kind of a general sense of security and safety, because that's been a birthright for us, that we haven't had that. And I think you can include gay male friends of mine have also said, what about gay men? I think there are some issues there as well. But in general, that's why it's important to be addressed, because by birth, we come from two very different standpoints and takes on the world and our security within it.
I think in addition to gay men, also children, young, very young people. But the systemic aspect of that is what I really would want to hone in on later.
To respond to Terry, I would say, for me, I can put men and women and children all in there. And when I look at, I bet we all have different definitions of feminism, but my definition of feminism is not the opposite of a male-dominated society. It's a new thing that goes beyond men or women in power. It's of something more egalitarian, coming from both sides. And I know men that are feminists as well in my definition of feminism, which is that. So I can put men in there, and I don't have a problem with that.
Okay.
I agree that what happens to women creates a different world, but I think we're part of the system of perpetuating that. When I think of Dorothy Day and the other one, Mother Jones, were not nonviolent women. They promoted social change through violence also. But we paint them, since they're females, they must be feminist, nonviolent. And when you mentioned Margaret Thatcher, I think we perpetuate it when we don't look at history differently. When we use, if it's female, she must have acted this way. If it's male, he's bad. And I don't think it's helping the conversation to continue it that way.
That occurred to me too, because when we were making the list, I kept thinking of people, women, and that, oh, wait, now that Joan of Arc, no, wait, she led an army. And I kept coming up with the wrong examples.
Okay.
I was also going to say that, as a woman, you're right, that's a huge generalization to say that that women experience violence more than men, but it is reality. I mean, and I'm a small woman, and I want to go travel in Europe. There's no way I'll ever be able to do that on my own safely. I mean, as men, I think you take for granted some things that women will never be able to do. The same way that as Caucasian Americans or Caucasian people will never understand the racism that other cultures experience, it's the same with women in our society. And I don't think that should be the entire basis of the discussion, but I think that's also very realistic.
Yeah. Okay.
I just want to say 2 seconds. I think in this discussion, if it's going to be a good discussion, that there should, no group should be threatened. And my dad and I had a conversation just last night about how do you talk about feminism without attacking men? And I think that's one of the issues. If we're going to start here, we have to have a basic definition of feminism, because it's been socially construed and kind of negated to mean a bunch of ugly things that it doesn't. And that we need to feel like it's not men or women yelling at each other. I mean, we're here in a forum tonight, so I can see this discussion going in a really bad direction.
Yeah. And I think in response to that, I would like to just briefly kind of sidestep and look into that particular issue. And that is, what do we mean when we're talking about feminism? Feminism is just like Christianity and just like other types of overarching labels. It has just as much diversity among it as it does as many other kind of paradigms for thinking. That there is liberal feminism, there's lesbian feminism, radical feminism. There's all manner of different kinds or genres or ways of thinking about feminism. And so to actually come up with one that we'd be using for a definition tonight would be very difficult and could take more hours than I think the whole program is even entitled to discuss. But I think that to be safe and to be able to come up with something that we can all, maybe we can't all, but that we can at least try and look at, is that feminism, and this is why, this is particularly in connection to this discussion, this is why I believe feminism is such a gift to nonviolence, or as Dr. Ann Brotherton talks about, something which deepens the principles of nonviolence, is that feminism is a lens through which we can view the world. Feminism is a lens which views the systems in which human beings interact. And just as nonviolence is a lens through which people view it, and then a way of also putting that into action, feminism is that means of viewing the world, seeing systems that are in operation, seeing how those systems affect various people within those systems, how it may affect people within those systems differently because of their gender, or their race, or their class, or their sexuality. Feminism is not just looking at the differences between men and women and how differently men and women necessarily have been treated. Rather, feminism is a very broad scope and a very broad lens through which the world is seen as a system of domination, a system which has been labeled the patriarchy. And it's a system in which there are kind of polar opposites, or this kind of bipolar thinking, in which there is male and there's female, there's heterosexual and there's homosexual, there's rich and poor, etc. And that one of those two groups has been historically dominant. And feminism seeks, in general, to view those systems, critique those systems, and then to change them. And that is an overarching enough kind of a look at feminism, and I can definitely and will open that up to discussion to see if that's something that we can all at least agree to for discussion tonight. That is, I believe, the connection between it and nonviolence, is that nonviolence seeks also to see that system of domination, that system of oppression, and to change it. But throughout it, not only does it view people systemically, but it also views people humanly, or as actual beings that are trapped within the system. So is that kind of an understanding of feminism that we can work from for discussion tonight? Any responses to that, or questions or comments at all? there. Oh, you're open. Okay, so I think that's where I think, for me, that's the gift of feminism to, one of the many gifts of feminism to nonviolence, is that deepening of the understanding of systemic oppression. And so, because of that, there are a few more kind of quotes here that I'd like to read. And that first one sparked quite a bit of conversation, and we'll see if we can continue looking at that. And this quote kind of flows from that same discussion. Individual acts of male violence against women flow from the values and structures of the domination system. The domination system maintains that there is an inherent imbalance of power between men, women and men. Feminism is the process of understanding this structural imbalance of power and changing it. Any reactions to that particular comment? So Terry, does that make sense as to what do you still have reservations, or what is that? Does that kind of make sense in the scope of what our discussion is tonight, or do you have any particular reaction to that at all?
I have no reaction.
Okay.
Okay. She does.
I do.
Okay, great.
Talking about feminism and male and female power balances, it's very easy to forget that men are oppressed by the same structure. Mm-hmm. And that we're talking about everybody. And it's a way to look at everyone. I mean, we're talking about the oppression of when men have feelings that they can't express, or love that they can't express, or in all the ways that you're supposed to be male, that you have to conform to the maleness, just as you're supposed to be female and conform to that role. So it's an oppressive system for everyone. And the idea that it's just for women is going to throw the world off balance too. Mm-hmm. I think the goal for, if I were in charge of the world, I'd say that we need to develop, each of us need to develop the female aspect of our characters to balance out the dominant male of our character that it's been historically.
That actually provides a wonderful segue to a quote from it's not from a Christian source, but I hope we can be forgiving on that. I know, but it comes from the leading prophet, the founding prophet of the Baha'i faith, which is a spirituality which strives consistently and historically for the last 150 years for a radical equality of men and women, and that is that the Baha'u'llah's vision of humanity is that humanity is like a bird with a male wing and a female wing, and that if both wings are not equally as strong and respected and encouraged and uplifted, then humanity can't possibly fly. In that way, then, men are just as affected and just as inhibited by the any gender roles or any structure which limits the freedom or expression of anyone. So thank you and I'm sure many of us within the room would probably agree that we would like you in charge of the world. Feminism exposes the gender roles assigned by society, the authority, the service provider, the victim, the rescuer, all those other kinds of roles or expectations that she was talking about. Dr. Rand Brotherton maintains that the key elements of the domination system, that feminism exposes and reveals the key elements of the domination system. Superiority and power over others, a society of in-groups and out-groups, we versus them, and a situation where peace is defined as control through the threat of violence. Historically, in our this whole entire century, well, at least since the birth of the bomb, is exactly that, peace through the control or by the threat of violence. And that feminism is that which sees that and unearths that and reveals that for what it is. And so, feminism, according to Anne Brotherton, is a lens through which to see how power is used and to see the consequences of the imbalance of power. But it is also a way to transform these relationships. This is the deep connection that it has to nonviolence, is that it unearths a power to transform those relationships and those roles. Part of this includes articulating and living out a series of feminist principles which deepen our nonviolence. And these I've put up on the board here. The six principles which deepen our nonviolence, feminist principles, are the fundamental importance of experience. Experience as our primary text. Another way of putting that this has been voiced by a lot of feminist movements is the importance of story, and the importance especially of listening and listening to story. And that if we are given both the courage and also the space to tell stories and to understand our experience and to utilize that, that is one of the key principles to a feminist understanding of nonviolence. The goal of life is not winning, but personal and social wholeness. A process that is human is one that advances mutuality and consensus, not hierarchy. A lot of organizations, because of the feminist movement, have moved away from Robert's Rules of Order to consensus type decision making because of the emphasis on hierarchy and so forth and those. So that's another one of the effects of feminism, which has affected a lot of different organizations, including several that I'm a member of. We are subjects and not objects. This is a deep, deep connection to the ecological movement as well, to revitalize the understanding that all beings, all things, be they human or not human, are subjects capable of acting and having inherent dignity and worth to them, rather than objects. The movement from subject or from object to subject is one of the most powerful gifts of feminism to the nonviolence movement because of its ability to empower and to give voice to the voiceless or the traditionally voiceless. The goal of nonviolence is change and not revenge. A belief that there are alternatives to violence and injustice. Now, what I'd like to do is move into a discussion because there, and it's an important discussion to have, because oftentimes one of the critiques of nonviolence, one of the things that is raised, and this has been raised by some feminists or by a lot of feminists, or people who have a misunderstanding of feminism and try and use their misunderstanding of feminism to attack the nonviolent movement, is the issue of self-defense. And so I'd like to kind of address that and to throw that out for discussion. I have my own theories about it, but I'd much rather hear yours. And then perhaps work through kind of an understanding that I've come through after hearing some of your own ideas as well. And that is that a lot of people have viewed feminism as perhaps a stumbling block to the nonviolent movement because of this idea of self-defense, especially when talking about domestic violence, rape, and other gender-motivated or gender-related violence. And that the argument then is that if nonviolence affirms that we are not to use violence to overcome violence or to fight back, that is, then the feminist movement or then anything which advocates women fighting back or even defending themselves in extreme cases of rape or domestic violence, that then that automatically disqualifies the nonviolent movement from being able to be aligned with them. And there's great room and a great deal of discussion regarding all of those issues, but I would much rather hear what you have to say in response to that. Does self-defense, I mean, there are a lot of self-defense classes and so forth that are really pushed by a lot of people who are proponents of feminism, does that mean then that element of feminism or that element of a women's movement is contrary to the ideals or principles of nonviolence? Because I think it's something a lot of people will raise two specific questions when talking about nonviolence. One is the issue of self-defense, not only in gender-related violence, but on a street corner if somebody's rushing at you with a knife, no matter who you are, and also the question of Hitler and extreme violence, but that's something that we can talk about later. So this issue is one of the first issues that a lot of people will raise when talking about nonviolence. So what is your response? Is self-defense, does that automatically, especially in situations of gender violence, but in any situation, does that disqualify one from being able to take the vow of nonviolence, for instance, or to strive for nonviolent principles?
Since this is a feminist discussion, I get to follow those points and tell a story.
Great.
And speak from experience. And it's my experience that after taking self-defense type courses, it made a big difference in my ability to move around in the world. And regardless of whether there are any arguments that anybody would make, wouldn't matter to me one bit, because I felt the benefit of self-defense in just the way I could move in the world, the way I could go places without as much fear, learning to handle my body, learning the few principles, getting the fear away so that I could do certain things. On the other hand, there's really no point in being a victim. There's no point in it. Sometimes there's a point in being a martyr for a cause. If you love a cause and you get hurt for it or you die for it, then it's a noble thing. But to just go out and be a victim, there's no point in it. It doesn't do anything. It doesn't solve anything. It doesn't create anything.
Any other reactions to it?
Well, self-defense to me seems to be an instinctive reaction. If somebody comes at you in a threatening way, my reaction is to defend myself against them.
Mm-hmm.
And so it seems as if nonviolent, one would have to train myself out of that to truly live by nonviolent principles. You have to override. I would have to learn to override my instinct of, reptilian brain. And that's a difficult thing to do.
Okay.
My first response would be to say, self-defense would be violent because it's physical and you would be hurting someone else. But at the same time, if I'm being raped, what then should I do?
There's self-defense courses. I took one in D.C. that is non-violent in that you're not using physical force to hurt someone and damage their physical being. That there's ways of knowing where someone, that they don't have strength to hold you or push you if you grab onto their elbow in a certain way, but you're not losing, you're not breaking bones. And I guess for me, there's ways of asserting yourself without creating more violence. And they don't work in all situations, but I don't think that self-defense is clearly a violent act of hitting or of retaliating, but it's of believing in yourself in some cases.
Okay.
I kind of like what's been said so far, but the one thing that I need help with is the whole concept of turning the other cheek. And how does that fit in there? I mean, the concept of not being a victim, that makes a lot of sense. But how do you...
Do you have the
Bible
study?
No.
Yeah.
That's when we answered it.
Yeah, does somebody want to give? Just do you want to kind of explain to him what your reaction to that would be?
Sorry,
do
it.
No, it was Jerry. Jerry
read the book. I don't know. That is a misinterpretation of what that means, of turning the other cheek. But that in context, turning the other cheek is not allowing yourself to be a victim.
but it is maintaining your dignity. That's in the cultural context, which has been misinterpreted in our context.
It's a process of demanding equality and demanding recognition of your own equality and your own dignity and your own humanness. And I'd love to go through it with you later if you want to.
But also the difference between defending yourself and doing a counterattack. There's a big difference.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me that feminism isn't against nonviolence. It's against a totally poor understanding of nonviolence. And nonviolence as passive, as submission, as if that's what nonviolence is, I don't want to be part of it. Gandhi doesn't either. King doesn't either. And Jesus doesn't either. The whole idea of nonviolence is, if it's to cause injury to the other person, if it's to take revenge, then it's violating these principles. But those are principles of feminism. And self-defense isn't to take revenge, doesn't cause injury, it's not to make the other person an object, but refuse to be a subject. And so it seems to me that feminism is, and nonviolence are hand in hand, but a false understanding. And Christians have perpetuated that, partly because of this totally misunderstanding of Jesus' words, you know, do not resist evil. But that's not what he said, but that's what the damn text says. You know, it was do not resort to violence in overcoming evil, but overcome evil with good and a whole bunch of things like that.
I think for me the problem problem with the self-defense question is that it goes about nonviolence backwards. And I think that that's the key for me to understanding both that issue and also the issue of extreme violence in the world and Hitler and how would you intervene in that particular issue. And this is another one of the extreme gifts or deepening that the feminist movement has given to nonviolence or has done for nonviolence. And that is that self-defense is that raising that question works at nonviolence backwards and goes from nonviolence as an issue of the victims and how they respond, which is absolutely opposite to this understanding of you know, challenging roles and challenging traditional and refusing to be victims and taking up space and so forth. That for me, when people will raise the question of self-defense, and it is raised any time I bring up nonviolence with anyone who has little or even who has some exposure to it but still is struggling with it, it is constantly raised, even by most notably by my father, any time I come home. I don't go home very often anymore, but that nonviolence, and especially feminist nonviolence, if there is a difference between those two, and that's something that we can talk about later if you'd like to, but feminist nonviolence is about creating a world in which women wouldn't have to defend themselves. Feminism and nonviolence is about creating a world in which Hitler doesn't exist, in which those kinds of problems don't exist. The failure to address those problems is our failure as passives, as opposed to pacifists. Failure to create a world in which women do not have to worry about whether or not self-defense is violent or not rests on everyone's shoulders as the problem of not creating a world in which, as we talked about this morning, not only do we talk about, well, yes, violence exists, so most notably young women, this is how you should respond, or this is who you go to in these particular cases. If you're ever raped, this is who you contact. But nonviolence, failure to use active nonviolence in an educational standpoint is the failure to create a world in which we take men aside as well, young boys aside, and teach them what is appropriate and what is inappropriate. And failure to utilize every media that we possibly can to create a world in which women don't have to defend themselves, in which children don't have to defend themselves, in which men, gay men or otherwise, don't have to defend themselves. Nonviolence is not about what you do when somebody is rushing at you with a knife. Nonviolence is not about what women should do if they're being raped. Nonviolence is about creating a world in which knives and rape don't exist. And that is one of the gifts of the feminist movement, is that it views those systems of oppression, it views the situations, the systems which place people in those situations, it sees them, it critiques them, and then it works to change them. And so this summer, Walter Wink's response to the Hitler question was that if Hitler ever happens again, it is because we, and most notably our churches, failed to create a world, failed to be prepared for that to happen, failed to create a world in which that wouldn't exist again. So for me, that is one of the ways to go about that particular self-defense question, because there are some self-defense classes which do teach methods which can be viewed as violent. But I am never going to be in the position in which I can pass judgment on anyone who uses any of those tactics. Because, first of all, I will never probably be in any of those situations, just simply because of how I was born. And number two, because the way in which I view feminism and nonviolence is from the entire other end, and that is that I work to create a world in which that won't happen. And in the process, I'll be damned if I place judgment on anybody who acts against it in whatever particular situation they're in. So that, to me, is the question. But that's an important issue to discuss, because a lot of people, especially when considering taking the vow of nonviolence, will wonder about the issue of self-defense. Now, to move, kind of transition, and I don't even know what time it is, unfortunately.
It's up time.
It's almost time, yeah. Well, that's really, really unfortunate. But I'm a collector of children's books, and unfortunately I couldn't bring any of them up here, but because I find the children's books are, well, first of all, the way children's toys and books and so forth programming are the way in which we raise our children in many ways, and depending on which books and which video games and which movies and so forth we allow our children to watch or that we give to our children, they'll be raised to think or do things in various different ways. And for me, another one of the gifts of both the feminist movement and the ecological movement is a reimagining. And that is that we re-image the way in we view ourselves, the way in which we view our world, the way in which we view God, and the way in which we view all the different actors within all of the way that we interact and so forth. And my favorite book, well, over any other book, regardless whether it's a children's book or not, is Old Turtle. And I'm not going to read the entire thing. Many of you probably have read it. If you haven't, I really suggest that you read it, because it's the most beautiful book in the universe. But what happens is that, and that's, of course, my own biased opinion, but what happens is all of the beings of the earth, and this is before humans came around, so this is rocks and rivers and trees and animals, all of them are arguing about who God is. And all of them attempt to establish that God looks just like them. And this is important because the other day we talked about this belief in a nonviolent God. And one of the biggest steps to creating a nonviolent world, or one of the biggest steps in this spiritual journey, is imagining the God that we have. How do we image God? Because it plays a huge role. If we image God as Father, and yet we were victims of domestic abuse as children, we're going to have a very different view of religion. And a very different view, whereas if we view God differently. So how we image God really does enter into this. If we image God as human, in general at all, as this kind of anthropomorphic God, if we view God as that, then the environmental question is going to really throw us into a tizzy. And that's one of the gifts of the ecological movement, is that it challenges us to revision how we view God and how we view our relationship to creation. And so all the different beings of the world and the earth before the humans come around are arguing about what God looks like. And all of them believe, much like I think most people within our own spiritual tradition and so forth believed as well, that God looks just like them. So the argument grew louder and louder and louder until stop. A new voice spoke. It rumbled loudly like thunder. And it whispered softly like butterfly sneezes. the voice seemed to come from, why it seemed to come from, Old Turtle. God is indeed deep, she said to the fish in the sea, and much higher than the mountains, she told them, or much higher than high, she told the mountains. He is swift and free as the wind, and still and solid as a great rock, she said to the breezes and the stones. She is the life of the world, Turtle said to the willow. Always close by, yet beyond, and the farthest twinkling light, she told the ant and the star. God is gentle and powerful, above all things and within all things. God is all that we dream of and all that we seek, said Old Turtle. All that we come from and all that we can find. God is. Old Turtle had never said so much before. All the beings of the world were surprised and became very quiet. But Old Turtle had one more thing to say. There will soon be a new family of beings in the world, she said, and they will be strange and wonderful. They will be reminders of all that God is. They will come in many colors and shapes, with many different faces and different ways of speaking. Their thoughts will soar to the stars, but their feet will walk the earth. They will possess many powers. They will be strong yet tender, a message of love from God to the earth and a prayer from the earth back to God. And the people came. And they're still coming. But the people forgot. They forgot that they were a message of love and a prayer from the earth. And they began to argue about who knew God and who did not, where God was and was not, and whether God was or was not. And often the people misused their powers and hurt one another or killed one another. And they hurt the earth, until even the forests began to die. And the rivers and the oceans and the planets and the animals and the earth itself, because the people could not remember who they were or where God was. Until one day there came a voice, like the growling of thunder, but as soft as butterfly sneezes. The voice seemed to come from the mountain, who rumbled, "Sometimes I see God swimming in the dark blue depths of the sea." And from the ocean, who sighed, "He is often among the snow-capped peaks, reflecting the sun." From the stone, who said, "I sometimes feel her breath as she blows by." And from the breeze, who whispered, "I feel his still presence as I dance among the rocks." And the star declared, "God is very close," and the island added, "His love touches everything." And after a long, lonesome, and scary time, the people listened and began to hear, and to see God in one another, and in all the beauty of the earth. And Old Turtle smiled, and so did God. That re-imaging and recognizing the inherent dignity and godliness of others, most notably that we were talking about tonight, women and children, the earth, the rocks, the rivers, etc. Recognizing the inherent dignity of everything within creation is probably the most monumental step that we can take and kind of laying the foundation and the groundwork for building a nonviolent movement which creates a world in which the patriarchal systems just don't exist, in which violence against the earth doesn't exist, so we don't have to worry about the question of eco-sabotage or other forms of radical environmental movement. When we don't have to worry about whether or not the question of self-defense can be raised when talking about rape, because rape doesn't exist. So that is, if anything, I think what we tell our children is the most important part, and we're all still children and still learning. So if you have a chance to read that book or any other book that is your favorite book about how you can look outside yourself and find something that's in there. So unfortunately, that leaves us with very little time. In fact, none. Yeah, it's 8:00.